You're listening to Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
We're going to start on page 3 tonight.
You're inside a book club meeting. The club started many years ago at the Venice Library. During COVID, it then, like everything else, moved to Zoom.
Janice is going to read the last page, 628, first, and then we're going to just jump into page 3.
It's really more a reading club than a book club. And what makes this club unusual is its members have spent the last 28 years reading one novel, just one. Now, in this meeting, they're starting it all over again.
We are ready to go. Janice.
The novel is Finnegan's Wake by the Irish writer James Joyce, known as one of the most difficult to read pieces of fiction ever written.
Sad and weary, I go back to you, my cold father, my cold, mad father. Mona Nonan makes me sea silt, salt sick, and I rush, my only, into your arms.
Look, I vaguely remember studying a Joyce novel in college. That was eons ago. But my basic impression is that he's, let's say, a little inaccessible. A drag? That's what KCRW reporter Anna Scott thought, too. Then she met the members of this Finnegan's Wake book club and came away with a totally different idea. And I think by the end of this story, you will too.
Yeah, Steve nailed it. My heritage is as Irish as it can get. All my grandparents were born in Ireland, but I've never gotten it with Joyce. I mean, can you imagine reading 600 plus pages of this?
I see them rising. Save me from those terrible prongs. Two more. One to more men's more. So, Ave Laval, my leaves have drifted from me.
It's hard to say what Finnegan's Wake, published in 1939, is about. Here's what Wikipedia says about the style. Quote, it is written in a largely idiosyncratic language, which blends standard English with neologisms, portmanteau words, Irish mannerisms, and puns in multiple languages to create a refracted effect. Here's how Jerry Fialka, founder of the Finnegan's Wake Reading Club, puts it.
It's almost like tripping on acid.
Fialka has white hair and a pair of purple-rimmed glasses pushed back on his head as we talk. I've never called anyone a far-out dude before, but in this case, it fits.
It is changing your sensory perception because you're literally looking at words that don't make sense. And the reason you look at words is to make sense.
We're speaking at Fialka's home in Venice, a cozy back house crammed with instruments, books, shelves of cassettes, and photos on the walls.
You're at the Fialka Funny Farm.
Okay. Feels like it.
Fialka's lived in Venice for 43 years. He's an experimental filmmaker and a one-time production assistant for Frank Zappa. He started the Finnegan's Wake Reading Club back in the 1990s, partly, he says, because there was no other way he'd have read the book.
So it was a selfish reason. Mom, it would give me a chance to read it, but more so to engage the community. Because, see, that's what I'm about, is sharing the experience of being with other people.
I thought it sounded interesting.
Steven Kudrowski joined the club around 2005. At the time, he lived in L.A. Now he's in Chicago, but he keeps up with the Zoom meetings.
I'd read Ulysses and I'd read Portrait of an Artist.
Two of Joyce's other novels.
I had never tried to tackle Finnegan's Wake because I'd always heard it was unreadable. Maybe I even looked at it at a bookstore one time and put it down quickly, like, you know, realizing I'd never be able to get through it.
But to Kudrowski, who's a novelist himself, the idea of wrestling through this confounding book with a group of people sounded fun. In fact, there are other Finnegan's Wake reading clubs around the world. But the one Jerry Fialka started in Venice may hold the record for taking the longest time to get from the first page to the last. I hesitate to say they finished the book because Finnegan's Wake is circular. The last sentence leads back into the first. So Fialka says they're not really starting over as much as continuing on.
Go ahead, Ted, back to the top.
This is sound from last Tuesday evening. About a dozen members are gathered on Zoom.
Ba 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 da ga ra ga ta ka min na ro.
They take turns reading a long, made-up word that's maybe supposed to be the sound of thunder.
Baba da la garg Takaminarong.
Baba Baba Garatakaminarong.
Baba Ba Dalgarak Takaminarong Khan Brantanaron Tuan Sirnuk.
After reading, the discussion zigzags from dissecting individual words to broader ideas. At one point, Fialka directs a question to member Nigel Donnelly.
Nigel, do most Irish people care about reading Joyce, read Joyce? You grew up there?
No, not really. He'd be avoided, I think, in most cases. just be a select set of people would get into it.
Later, Fialka turns to some club members who've been mostly quiet, like Joseph Patwell.
Joseph, how did this page make you feel? Any comments?
I've read this page maybe 100 times. You know, I understand very little of it. You know, it's lovely to hear, but it, to me, has no meaning.
And you know what? In this club, that's okay. As impenetrable as Finnegan's Wake is, Fialka says, you will experience flickers of understanding simply by plodding through it.
You'll have a revelation, or what Joyce called so appropriately, epiphanies in everydayness. Mm. Like everyone can have a wow moment, aha moment in the simplest of things. And in the midst of something that seems complex, if it flips in the aha moment, you're like, wow, you know, it's an amazing experience.
Besides that, he says, as club members have come in and out over the years and monthly turnout has fluctuated between a few dozen and less than half that,
I've gotten to encounter a lot of people who become my friends and share a commonality in what reading does to humans.
And that is pretty far out. For KCRW, I'm Anna Scott.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
More now with Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chittakis. He's a Brit turned Angelino who belts out line after line in a long life of singing and songwriting, where ballad creation rules the day and sparkling romance rules the night.
So I sing you to sleep after the loving with a song I just wrote yesterday. And I hope you can hear what the words and the music have to say.
After at least 7 decades in the music business, Engelbert Humperdinck is still ready to play. And he's featured in a new documentary about his life called Engelbert Humperdinck. The legend continues. Welcome to KCRW.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
It's nice to have you here. Some people call you a balladeer.
I am a balladeer, yes.
But some say you're a crooner.
Mm-hmm. No.
No? Smooth crooner?
No. It's not that I don't like the word, but, you know, when I started singing, I had a 3.5-octave range. And crooners don't have that.
Yeah.
You know, they have a 1.5.
So there's like a definition between balladeer and crooner.
Yes.
Yeah. How about thespian of song?
You're using my statement, right?
You like that, right?
I started saying that a long time ago because I feel that, you know, being an artist, you have to portray it in a way that actors do when they're in front of a camera or whatever it is. You know, you have to use your eyes, your nose, your mouth, your face, your actions, your body language. You know, it's all acting.
It's a full performance.
And it's a performance, full performance, yeah. And that's what I do when I'm on stage, you know, and that's one of the reasons why I describe myself as a thespian of song.
Thespian of song.
Yeah.
Engelbert Humperdinck is not your real name. You were born Arnold Dorsey.
Yes.
Right? But where did Engelbert Humperdinck come
from?
Well,
actually, It happened a long time ago when I had a manager called Gordon Mills, who was the genius who changed my name. I shared an apartment with him. And then he became a songwriter, and then he became a manager. He managed three people, Tom Jones, Gilbert O'Sullivan, and myself. And he gave us all names. I mean, he gave Gilbert his name, he gave Tom his name, and he gave me this name. But he gave me the longest name.
This documentary has a David Attenborough feel. And I love it because, you know, you're a true performer in your role, a role that you've played most of your life. Every day I wake up and I start to break up,
lonely as a man without love. In between shows, there's the constant demand for a performer to be what his fans expect him to be. Interviews, meetings, videos, photo shoots, it's all part of life in the spotlight. He's not only a perfectionist on stage, but in every facet of his art. And this is just part of building a legacy as a consummate performer.
It's like you're being examined in the wild in a BBC documentary.
You mentioned David Attenborough, right?
Yeah,
you know, David and Richard Attenborough come from my hometown in Leicester.
Oh, really? In England?
Yeah.
What was the impetus to make this documentary right now?
You know, people kept saying, why don't you do some? They asked me, why didn't I have an autobiography? And then I eventually did an autobiography. And then I decided to get my life on a documentary and show people the little pieces of footage that they've never seen before and talk about things that they've never heard about before.
You are 87 years old.
I certainly am.
You don't look a day past like 60. I'm telling you, I hope if I, you know, my lips to God's ear, make it to 87,
yeah,
I look as good as you.
Thank you very much.
And you have all this energy, still with a cigar, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, still with a cigar, the cognac. Where does it come from?
I don't know. You see, I come from a family of 10. You know, that's seven sisters and two brothers. And I'm the only one out of the entire 10 I had the urge to go into show business, you know. But I think I took after my mother, because my mother had this beautiful operatic voice, you know, and very powerful. She used to shake the windows and chandeliers when she hit the high notes. I guess I got my talent from her and my power and from my father, you know. He was a wonderful man and very powerful, a powerful person, and I admired him greatly.
You're actually playing the Saban Theater here in L.A. You're playing. Yes. You're still performing.
I'm still performing all over the world, in fact, you know. As a matter of fact, I just got back from the Philippines, and I played three concerts over there, which were sold out, thank God. You know, I've never been there for a while, and it was so nice.
Does it take something now out of you to do it, or are you just, is it just like, this is what I'm doing, this is what I do?
Well, actually, the only problem I have is putting my show together.
Like what songs to sing?
Yeah. But, you know, my act is sort of trial and tested. It's been around the world several times. And I find that people like certain songs that are out of my repertoire. So I keep them in my show and just change a couple of things here, there, and everywhere, you know, just to give them a variety now and again.
You live in L.A., right?
I do, yes. Yeah.
Have you been here a long time?
I started living here in 75.
Wow.
I bought my first house in 75, yeah. And it was a very famous house, by the way.
Which one?
It was called the Pink Palace that Jane Mansfield used to live in.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I lived in it for 29 years with my family. And eventually I sold it in 2004. And they told me they were going to bring it back to pristine condition. 2 weeks later, it was down.
They demolished it.
They demolished it.
Oh.
And I was so upset. I was so upset. If I'd known that, I would never have sold it.
There was a heart-shaped pool, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, they demolished that too?
Everything.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Yeah, it was such a wonderful, wonderful place and very noticeable because it was pink, you know?
Yeah, the Pink Palace.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is, and you mentioned your family. It's impossible to watch this documentary and not see how important your family is. Your daughter's with us right now, as a matter of fact.
Yes, she is. Yes, she is.
In the studio. And I wonder if you can talk about that, how despite all the travel and work, you managed to make family a priority.
Well, my family is like my own family. My sisters and brothers were all very close, and so therefore when I had created, well, when my wife and I created this little family of ours, they sort of took on that same attitude. And they're all very loving and caring, you know. And my wife, my darling wife is not with us anymore. But
64 years you were married.
Yeah, we were married for a long time.
She had had Alzheimer's?
Yes, she did, yeah. We tried everything. We really, I mean, I went to acupuncture, through all sorts of natural kind of cures. I'm sure they've got a cure out there, and I wish they'd bring it in as soon as possible. It's such a cruel disease.
It really, because it affects everybody. Everybody in the family.
Yeah.
Everybody, friends, family, because, you know, they don't suffer alone.
Yeah.
And then they forget.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, it is cruel.
During the COVID period, I wasn't working, so I was able to stay with her day after day. And I realized that when I watched her condition, that she probably could understand and hear, but couldn't respond back to you, you know? And that was the sad part about it.
A lot of experts say music helps.
Yes.
In the remembering as
yes,
well.
Yes, it does. I used to see her little foot shake like that, you know, when the music was on. Yeah. And so therefore it was, you know, I always say where there's life, there's hope. And that's why we tried everything, every situation, trying to get her better.
I was enchanted with your scene in the documentary with your shirt maker, Mr. Alex.
Yes.
Mr. Alex makes a lot of threads for you, doesn't he?
Oh, he certainly did, yeah. He's a wonderful man, and as a matter of fact, we still use him to this day, you know.
He really?
Oh, yes.
Did he make the shirt you're wearing right now?
No, this is not one of his shirts, right. But I do, most of my stage shirts are done by him, and in the early days, we have to make quite a lot because they used to get ripped off you and things like that.
Ripped off you?
Yeah. Well,
by
you know,
in the adoring fans.
When the crowds come on stage, they'll, you know, that sort of thing.
How did you take that?
That's part of the game.
Yeah.
Part of the game, and you know, they wanted a piece of you, so they took the pieces of you. Sometimes I'd walk off stage with just cuffs on, you know.
Your documentary premieres tonight.
It certainly does, yeah.
In Hollywood at the Montalban Theater.
Yes.
So tickets still available for that. I want to thank you for coming on and talking with us today. Thanks for taking me on a one-way trip to the sun. I wanted to say that, by the way. It's one of my favorite lines in music.
A one-way trip to the sun. Yeah.
Are you singing it? Will you sing it? Thanks for taking me. Come on. Will you do it for us?
Well, it's a little early for
it's
me.
It's a little. Yeah. Okay. All right. Engelbert Humperdinck, what an honor. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you very much.
Onward now with Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Hollywood has a long history of misrepresenting or even omitting indigenous communities on film. But one big way to change that is by giving more native filmmakers a platform to tell those stories themselves. It's one of the goals of the annual LA Skins Fest, which has been showcasing some of the best work by indigenous filmmakers from North and South America for 17 years. Well, this year's six-day festival kicks off tonight, and here to talk about it, tell us what's on the lineup, is festival founder Ian Skorodin. Hi, Ian.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing all right. Tell me, how and why did you start this festival 17 years ago?
Well, I founded the festival because there was just a lack of genuine, authentic connection between our community and the industry. I myself was fresh off of a festival tour. I wrote and produced and directed a feature film that I was at a tour. I went to Sundance, Munich, et cetera, et cetera. When I was done with my tour, I realized I, you know, had a lot of desire, a lot of ability, but I needed additional artistic and creative development, so the first thing I felt was that as a filmmaker just being a part of a marginalized community, first things first was, you know, to have a film festival that could really platform a lot of our artists and storytellers. in 2007. I launched the LA Skins Fest. You know, skin is a term, you know, that the Native community used in Oklahoma. Oklahoma is, you know, where I was born, raised for some of my youth, and also went to college. So skins is like an insider term. It's not for everyone to understand.
I mean, historically, Ian, Hollywood has leaned into a lot of stereotypes, right, about the community. Talk a little bit about that history and how you're trying to sort of right the ship.
I think, you know, Hollywood, you know, the industry as a whole just has a hard time sometimes grasping new communities, you know, whether it's genuine or whether they want, you know, just to, of course, you know, maximize the business side of things. Having been around a long time, I see the ebb and flow of interest when it comes to our community. You know, in the 90s, TNT had a lot of Native American films that they wanted to make, you know, and then, you know, that kind of went away. Last Mohicans, Dances with Wolves also brought a lot of interest. And so we're seeing that again, but then we're also seeing that start to wane. And so the main thing now is to make sure that the voice that the industry is going towards or showcasing is actually the genuine voice of our community. Because right now what we're seeing is, you know, people who don't properly represent our community, who maybe aren't even indigenous and want to represent our community. So, you know, so we still have a long ways to go in terms of, you know, making sure that our community and our storytellers, our artists, our filmmakers are the ones who are actually leading the charge and making sure that their stories are the ones that are being told.
What about some of the more recent works from Hollywood? I'm thinking of Killers of the Flower Moon, which is out right now, or Reservation Dogs. I mean, do you think things are getting better? You mentioned Last of the Mohicans and the others. Those date back, you know, decades. But there are some newer things, movies out these days that maybe, you know, showcases the indigenous community. Do you think that's true, or do you think Hollywood still has a ways to go?
Well, so specifically, Killers of the Flower Moon, that's not written and directed by a Native person. While there's a lot of, you know, Indians there, and there's Indians who have, you know, some dimension to them, it still isn't from our perspective. And so that's really important to cross over to that kind of positioning where we are writing and directing and calling the shots. You know, that's really important that we don't just get showcased and our stories get showcased, but we have to be in charge of the story and the storytelling. And there's other things that need to be addressed with films like that as well. You know, as a Native person and as a lot of Native people, you know, I think we're just tired of seeing, the portrayal of the victimhood and the victimization of our people. The thing we need to be careful of is that, you know, it's the portrayal of people being a victim and always having to be carried by somebody else or saved by somebody else. That's the thing that we really don't want to be portrayed anymore. We have a lot of stories where we've picked ourselves up, where we didn't, you know, have to rely on others to help us. So there's a lot of other ways to go about that where you're showing a perspective where, yes, we were, something really terrible happened to us, but that doesn't mean that we're, you know, that that's who we still are, you know, and that we've come a long way from then.
The festival, as I mentioned, kicks off tonight. What are some of the films that you're most looking forward to?
You know, we're showing over 65 films, so I can't play favorites because there's so many great films. We're showing a lot of shorts programs. Some of the features we have include Bad Press, which is a documentary about some of how tribes handle their press. A lot of tribes are supposed to have a free press, and there can be issues there. And then also we're showing A Fried Bread Face and Me, which is a celebrated film that is made by filmmaker Billy Luther. And really, it's a really interesting coming of age story from like a different perspective. Those are all showing throughout the weekend.
Well, you'll be able to see the movies at the TCL Chinese Theater. The kickoff is tonight with a big ceremony. Ian Skorodin, founder of LA Skins Fest, in Hollywood this week for the next 6 days. More information, by the way, about the fest and how to buy tickets at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. Ian, thanks for coming on and talking with us. We appreciate it. Good luck.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Going to do it for us this evening. Tomorrow, an update on the new contract for actors who are members of SAG-AFTRA, of course, just resolved. What was in the deal? And IATSE could be next. That union with a contract that expires next year. That's tomorrow on the show. On Thursday, how's the transition going at LADWP to getting energy from renewable sources? The utility has a goal. Is it on track to meet that goal? That's later this week on GLA. You can find us online anytime at kcrw.com/GreaterLA. Maybe you have a story for us. Maybe you want to just vent about something, or just find the podcast. You can do it there at kcrw.com/GLA, or get the podcast wherever you get your podcasts by searching KCRW Greater LA. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthew, Kelsey Gante, Eddie Sun, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Katie Gilchrist, Sue Margulies, Phil Richards, Amy Todd, Carlos Ramirez, Michael Vogel, Jocelyn Rohrbach, and Christian Bordahl all helped run the episode this evening. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your time and that ear. Have a great night.